Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is the two Matts for the week ending Friday, June the 30th.
It is indeed.
A place, it says here, to make sense of the past week in politics in the company of two hacks that have seen it all.
They'll be along in a minute.
No. Anyway.
Meanwhile.
You'll have to do with us. We'll need a title for this episode. What should we call it?
I think it should be A Tale of Two Cities.
Do you know why you think that? Because I suggested it earlier and you went, yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah,
that's you exactly steal
what,
my idea.
Exactly what happens.
So anyway, this is The Two Matts, episode two, A Tale of Two Cities.
Tale of Two Cities.
So what are we going to talk about?
We should talk a bit about London.
Yes.
It's very interesting what's happening in the London mayoral contest. The Conservative side against Sadiq Khan, who's going for a third term, eminently defeatable on a variety of issues. I mean, he's not been a disaster at all, but, you know, third term is hard to get.
Yeah.
But what's really interesting is that the Conservative slate has been so minimal. And became even more minimal this week when Daniel Korski, who was a former special advisor to David Cameron, was named by Daisy Goodwin, the TV producer and executive, as the man she alleges groped her.
Yeah, and he denies it.
He denies this very strongly. But I mean, I have to say that name has been floating around behind the scenes for which does. Beg the question, why did no one vet Korski's nomination? Because I remember when Boris Johnson was running for mayor. Now, David Cameron and George Osborne hated Johnson, you know, for all the reasons that, you know, became quickly apparent. However,
did they knew he was going to be Boris Johnson, the Boris Johnson we know and love now?
Well, all the characteristics that have now become sort of nationalised, if you like, were evident, and they dealt with him for many years, and they didn't like him and felt he was a opportunistic, rogue, you know, agent, which is indeed the case. Mm. However, the reason I mention it is because this is going back to 2008. They were, in spite of their feelings about him, very much involved in the process of nomination for the London mayoral contest, because they knew he was a winner. And they knew that for all their dislike and reservations about him, you know, he could win. And if he won, that would be a very helpful, you know, fillip to their chances in the general election of 2010. Yes. And I think it was. Now, were they right to back Johnson is a different question. But the point is, Sunak has been totally hands off in this, and the consequence is that you've ended up basically with Korski out of the picture with two people that no one's heard of.
Yeah.
Susan Hall, who's been leader of the London Conservatives on the Assembly.
Catchphrase, safer with Susan.
Safer with Susan, she owns a hair salon. And then a barrister called Moz Hussain, who really has almost no name recognition. Mm. So, you know, he's a KC, obviously an intelligent man, but it'll be Susan Hall because she's, you know, way ahead. And the reason I find it very odd is that, for reasons I'm not quite clear on, the system of voting next year for the mayoralty of London is being switched to first past the post. And that means that a Tory candidate who managed to capture just enough of the kind of coalition that Johnson got together in 2008 could pull it off. Now, it's a big ask in the context of the Tories free-falling nationally. But still, you'd think they would go for it. But they're barely involved.
Yeah.
You know, they're just not in the room.
Why is that? I mean, why is Sunak so detached from it? If it's important,
I think this is, you're looking at a sort of systemic failure now,
yeah.
Which is that they know it's over.
Yeah,
large numbers of them are looking for jobs, which is, you know, does occupy quite a bit of bandwidth. I don't think Sunak is a instinctive guerrilla politician. He wouldn't think, hey, you know, if we had a good showing in London, that might
shift the
scales a little bit. Yeah. I don't think that's how he thinks at all.
No.
And I think he'd probably regard it as an embarrassing sideshow, to be honest.
Patience Wheatcroft wrote a very good piece a few weeks ago in the New European that he's quit. He's checked out.
I think, and she's absolutely spot on. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, we'll see him mumbling his sound bites and his five pledges until the death. Yeah. But I don't think you're watching a politician who really even pretends to believe he has a chance of winning.
The other thing, which we should probably get a clip, I bet you Matt, our producer, can get a clip of this, was that extraordinary rant of Ben Elton's about Sunak. And the key phrase, well, let's see if we can get a clip.
The fact that the Tories chose that easy option, for a man now to say, we don't take easy options, when they took the easy option, which was Johnson, because they thought it would keep them in power, and when they thought for a moment he wouldn't, they dumped him instantly. I mean, he's the Prime Minister. He owes us honesty, and we got nothing but mendacity, evasion, and vanity, just dripping with vanity.
Fair to say that you are not convinced, I think.
And that's that key phrase to me, which I think resonated with people, about him dripping with vanity. And there is something about him that is inordinately vain.
Yeah.
You know, preening, self-adoring.
He's been winning since he was in his teens.
Yeah.
I mean, he never loses an opportunity to remind us that he worked in a pharmacy, often posing in front of a pharmacy to make the point.
Yeah.
But the truth is, you know, he was head of school at Winchester, then he went to Oxford, got a first, worked for a hedge fund, went to Stanford Business School, Goldman Sachs. I mean, the career has just been glittering. Married a billionaire.
Yeah.
I mean, he hasn't... And he had a brief sort of hiccup over the family's personal finances in the spring statement. But he came back from that, won the leadership, number 10. So really, he's never lost. And he's staring down the barrel now of one of those things that prime ministers sometimes... you know, good and bad, actually, but just for various reasons, it happens to them that, you know, they are beaten.
Yeah.
And it's a very, very unpleasant thing, and it's a humiliation on a national and global scale. I don't think he's remotely prepared psychologically. I mean, who is for that moment? But, you know, whereas you've watched Gordon Brown come back and be, you know, become a very active figure in national politics and global politics as well.
Yeah.
I would be very surprised if Sunak post-defeat does that. I think he'll go off. They've got a place in California.
Yeah.
You know, he'll no doubt pick up hugely remunerated financial jobs, and I think that's...
And we'll see him on Remembrance Day, and that'll be that.
That'll be that. I mean, yeah. I'd be surprised. Could happen. I'd be surprised if he became a national treasurer, as amazingly Theresa May seems
to have
become.
It's weird, isn't it? Because he, out of the car crash of Johnson and Truss, out of that, he came out, and it almost felt... Do you remember the commentary at the time was that the Tories have made a fresh start? It's a fresh start with Sunak. And it did sort of feel like, okay, well, at least we've got somebody sensible. But it masked that, the complicity that is all over him with what had gone before. He got away with a lot to start with.
He had. I mean, the sort of irony of Sunak is that he looks like a Remainer.
Yeah, but he isn't.
He absolutely isn't. He's a very committed Brexiteer. And we forget, you know, he got a fixed penalty notice for breaking COVID regulations and lots of question marks around his finances, keeping a green card longer than he really needed in America.
That was one of the things that struck me as... absolutely appalling. Yeah. Was the fact that he had that in his back pocket as a route out. You know,
so he's not as theatrical in his kind of brandishing of his politics of entitlement as Boris Johnson. I mean, who could be?
Yeah,
but actually, his sense of entitlement runs deep, but in a different way.
Yeah.
And I think people, I could be wrong, but I think the voters sense that.
Yeah.
I think part of his problem is that it comes across, it comes through the screen, that this is not a man who understands. When he says, you know, what was his phrase about mortgages?
Hold your nerve.
Hold your nerve.
Cheeky bastard.
I mean,
a billionaire telling people who might be about to lose their homes, hold your nerve.
And are having, as a consequence of, you know, coming mortgage rises, having to think
yeah.
very hard about how they
yeah.
feed and clothe their kids.
Yeah.
Hold your nerve. Well, nerve doesn't put food on the
table.
There was
a brilliant piece by on Sunday in The Observer, I think, or The Guardian, it might have been on Monday, by John Harris. Who?
Yeah, excellent.
So John Harris is a journalist, I think. I've got a huge amount of respect for him. Once I met him and he said something nice to me about an award that the New European had been given. And I then was presumptuous and said, would you one day write for us, perhaps, you know? And he sneered at me and said, why on earth would I want to do that? So my respect for him soared at that point as he told me to F off, kind of with a smile on his face. But the real reason I respect him...
He's a great journalist.
..is he gets out there. That's his whole shtick, is he goes and sees what's actually happening.
He won the Orwell Prize
yeah.
Not so long ago, and rightly so, he's a great journalist. Another thing to his credit is that because he gets out, John spotted that the Brexiteers were going to leave.
Yeah.
We were going to win.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot sooner than yeah. most people.
And what the piece he wrote this weekend was how... He called it the politics of complete despair or something like this.
Yeah.
You know, he said that the mood in the nation at large, he said in places like little country villages, you know, small affluent towns, he said there is a real despair at large in the country now.
Yeah.
And he's never felt anything quite like it. But it's the same kind of vibe that produced Brexit. But he was asking the question, what does this add up to?
You know? Yeah, it's a really difficult one because... despair is not a party political issue.
Right.
You know, it afflicts all people. It afflicts all parties seeking off electoral office.
Yeah.
If the voters generally, as John Harris describes them, are suffering from a bout of despair, quite a prolonged one, it's very difficult, especially for a progressive party like Labour, to mobilise opinion to say it's worth turning out to the polling booth because,
yeah.
you know, your lives will get better, not immediately, but we promise somewhere down the line. Well, you know, they've been waiting for their lives to get better since 2016, and it's all part of the corrosions of Brexit we've discussed
right.
before. But I do think that was a great piece, but also a very troubling piece.
And well, also, I mean, just think, you know, you and I are both old enough to remember that period where
yeah.
people, you know, where negative equity and people literally posting their keys back through the bank's letterbox. Well, you couldn't do that now because you couldn't find a bloody bank on the high
Where
street that's open
it?
Anymore. But, you know, people who face existential threats to their family life,
yeah.
you know, and then you've got wealthy people who are suddenly feeling, well, I can't go on holiday now. You know, so they're feeling really crunched as well in their own way. You do get this malaise in the nation that you could see it persisting for quite some time. And presumably, Starmer is going to inherit this. And as you just said, he's got no immediate quick fixes at all.
No, how could he? I mean, it's going to take several years, perhaps many years,
yeah.
to repair the damage
yeah.
done by this government. But I think just going back to London for a second, I mean, what was interesting about the Johnson campaign and then his absolutely flagrant hijacking of the 2012 Olympics, for all the fact that it was cheeky and, you know, a sign of terrible things to come when he became prime minister, what it did do was it suggested at that point, at least, that the Conservatives were a party that took the capital city seriously.
Yeah.
You know, because if you don't, I mean, London is a, you know, the huge argument to be had about the weight of London versus the rest of the country. And there is some polls show that London versus the rest of the country is now the biggest divider.
Yeah.
You know, but nonetheless, unless London is humming as a wealth creator, as a, you know, successful, reasonably cohesive city, you know, the country's not...
Everything suffers. Yeah.
And to find that the Conservatives are just treating it as a kind of sideshow,
yeah,
tells you really all you need to know about them. Well, that's them. But, you know, it's not much fun for Londoners, and also it's worrying for the rest of the country.
And what's your prediction then on how it will play out, Susan Hill versus Sadiq Khan?
I think Sadiq will win quite easily.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's a whole battle about emission zones and crime rates and so on. I mean, there are issues in London.
Yeah.
But, you know, Sadiq is a very seasoned campaigner.
He's an adult, you know.
He's a grown-up, yeah. and he knows the answers to the questions that will be posed. And she will... She's a big Trump supporter, by the way.
Yeah.
Enough said.
Well, you're wearing... The listeners don't know this unless you're watching on YouTube, but you've got a fantastic T-shirt with a great quote from Succession on it. What's the quote?
I love you, but you're not serious people.
You're not serious people. And these guys that the Tories are putting up are not... They're not no, serious I mean, people,
the, are they? The You know, we both believe in the role of mischief and wit and so on and irony in journalism. And you know, it's, I think, oddly enough, it's a sign of seriousness that you do assign a role to humour. But I do not think that these politicians we have at the moment on the Tory side are serious.
Yeah.
And, you know, the longer they hang on, which is what they're doing...
Yeah. In some cases, even longer than they promised to. I mean,
yeah.
Today we've got the report where Rees-Mogg, Nadine Dorries, are castigated for contempt of Parliament.
Yes.
For calling this a kangaroo court that has damned Boris Johnson. You know, it feels like the end of days for the Tory party, but it can't be, because we've got to keep checking ourselves and reminding ourselves that the Tory party is the most successful political party on the planet.
I think that's right, but I also think that I struggle when I try to work out what a post-election Tory party will be doing to increase its chances of getting back into office, because the one nation Conservative Party that everyone is expecting to re-emerge just doesn't exist anymore.
No, that's right.
And so you're right. But at the moment, the division is a tribal, factional one. It's between the sort of Sunakians who are kind of desperate for Boris Johnson to go away. And then there are the defenders of Boris Johnson, whom you just named, who are going on Newsnight and other programmes rubbishing the Privileges Committee as a kangaroo court. And, you know, anyone who read the report reasonably could see that they had no reason to find Johnson guilty.
In a word, is there a route back for Johnson despite it all still?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, his prospects are brighter than Sunak's.
It's incredible. It's what our fellow podcaster Alistair Campbell calls the turd that will not be flushed.
I mean, I'm not saying he will become leader again, but he's obviously not finished, and he has a bully pulpit in his new Mail column.
He's up there with Adrian Childs banality.
Well, phoning it in that has taken on a new meaning, hasn't
How
it?
How much do you reckon they're paying him for that?
Well, we know it's under a million, but not much. I mean, that is a lot of paper.
I don't know what's worse, Declan Rice for 105 million to Arsenal or Boris Johnson for a million to the
Mail. I mean, as transfers go, I think in terms of goals scored, it's not necessarily going to
prove
a good ratio. But it is interesting, and it shows you a lot about the future of the right, which is there is going to be the Boris camp, which will include... the Daily Mail and others.
Yes.
And then there will be others who are still Brexit, pro-Brexit, but try and dial back slightly.
Maybe the Telegraph in there. It depends who their new owner is.
It depends entirely on who the new owners are. That's why that's important. But, you know, it will be varieties. It'll be like COVID. You know, we're talking variants of the Brexit disease here. And it won't be. There isn't a one nation candidate waiting in the wings. The One Nation movement, if it is to become a force again in the Tory party, has to start rebuilding from scratch, because it doesn't have people.
No.
You know, he got rid of them all. in 2019. They're gone.
Fascinating. Anyway, well, let's leave it there for the time being, because that's going to rumble on and on. Let's take a quick break. But when we come back, what do you fancy talking about?
Well, I think should we talk about Paris?
What's I going on definitely there? Would like to talk about that's the events fun. In Paris.
Okay. A tale of two cities.
Possible title contender. Possible title. Okay, see you in a minute, folks.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The New European is one of the fastest growing titles in Europe, and for a very good reason. If you're fed up of the same corrosive nationalistic agenda peddled by right-wing media dominating the UK news agenda, then do something positive about it and subscribe. We're not just endless diatribes against Brexit, although if that is your thing, you won't be disappointed. But we've also got a fantastic arts and culture section and a bunch of fantastic columnists, including Alistair Campbell, Bonnie Greer, the philosopher Nigel Warburton, and of course the giant of journalism that is Matt D'Ancona. Subscribe from just £1 a week for our digital package, or if like me, you love getting your hands on the actual newspaper each week, you can have that delivered to your door for just another £1 a week, and that's a saving of 75% of the retail cover price. And for listeners of the Two Mats, I'm giving new subscribers a £25 gift voucher for our shop. That's enough for a great t-shirt or one of our best-selling Bollocks to Brexit burgundy passport covers. So go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2mats, that's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S, and do something positive about supporting great journalism today. That's theneweuropean.co.uk/2mats. So, Paris, ugly, ugly scenes horrible. This week. I made the mistake of watching the video on Twitter, and
it's pretty vile.
To describe the scene, a traffic cop armed with a submachine gun pointed at a windscreen at a young man, a 17-year-old, it turns out, of Algerian descent, in a suburb of Paris.
Only identified as Nahel.
So Nahel M, yeah. And in a routine traffic stop, the cop is heard to say, "I'm going to stick a bullet in your head." The guy drives off. I'd have bloody driven off in those circumstances. If I'd have been able to summon the energy to move, I'd have been in such
fear. I mean, rational in a situation of rational behaviour in a situation of utter terror.
And as he moves off, boom, the bullet goes through the windscreen.
Yeah, and kills him.
Kills him. And the car goes off. It's just.
He was a baby.
17 years old.
I mean, you know, that's the bit that really kind of makes me
rigid
with fury, because he was a baby. No, I'm not saying it would be fine if he was 27. No. Of course it wouldn't.
Yeah.
But a 17-year-old
yeah,
equivalent of a sixth former,
yeah,
in a car, shot,
yeah,
at point blank range by a traffic cop
on a random stop. It's not even like Mark Duggan, for instance, in Tottenham,
no,
where, you know, that he was, that was a whole huge operation.
That was an exchange, you know? Yeah. It's a judicial execution of a child.
It's exactly that. And to Macron's credit, although this is about as far as the credit extends, I think, Macron has said this is indefensible. The good news is the cop is up for murder, effectively. But there are now a procession of riots and huge demonstrations in Paris and across France about this awful incident. And one thing that absolutely stopped me in my tracks when I was reading the first news reports on it was the statistics of how many people the French police kill each year.
Go on.
So last year, I think it was 37 people. So that's basically one person every 10 days the French police kill. This is compared to the UK, where it's regularly two or three or four, or two or three or four as you go through the years. The French death toll is regularly late 20s, early 30s, sometimes 40 people a year. And the majority of those people are people of immigrant descent. So, and the vast majority of people killed in traffic stops, which it's absolutely unbelievable. But there are, every year at random traffic stops, a number of people are killed, and the majority of those are of Algerian immigrant descent. You have this situation in a country of comparable population and comparable history, colonial history, but you have a ferociously different situation when it comes to racism. And what seems to be deeply institutionalised racism.
Well, we have to sort of fess up, which is that, you know, Louise Casey did a big report on the Met, which found that,
yes,
in March, that it was institutionally, yes, racist. Yes. And there was a report by the Independent Office for,
yeah,
Police Conduct, which found that across, I think, 2011-21, people of colour in this country are seven times more likely to die,
yeah,
than white people.
And nine times more likely, if you're a young black guy, nine times more likely to be stopped than a young white guy. You know?
So we yeah, you know, we do not come to this discussion
no.
with clean hands. However, there is a difference of kind, I think, in the racism on both sides of the channel, which is evidenced by the kind of brazenness, if you like, of what happened this week. And it says a lot about the incredibly troubled history of French,
yeah,
the French approach to Algeria,
to
the Maghreb, to North Africa.
Yeah,
I mean, it is. This goes back a long way.
Well, that's what I thought was interesting to talk about, just how far it goes back. And I know you have seen, it's one of my favourite films. I mean, it's one of the darkest films I've ever seen, La Haine.
It's a great classic movie. And hard to watch, but it's brilliant.
It starts with that fantastic opening line. I think it's Saeed, who is the Algerian immigrant, who is narrating the first opening scenes. And he talks about the tensions in France, and he says something like, France is like a man falling from the top of a skyscraper. And every floor he passes, he says to himself, so far, so good. So far, so good. And it felt like, you know, you were hurtling towards catastrophe. And but at the same time being in this state of denial. And it does happen in France. Every 10 years it seems to happen. You know, 95, there were huge riots.
2005,
the cops, there were two Algerian descent kids electrocuted, running away from police. And this is what I thought was the interesting point about this stop. And, you know, we should say we don't know the circumstances.
No.
But it would seem clear that this kid just didn't want to get involved with these police. And this was very similar to that case in 2005, where the kids were running away, not because they'd done anything wrong, but because they just didn't want to get arrested, taken to a police station.
In mortal terror.
Interrogated for 4 or 5 hours, have their parents called out to get them released from jail. Because that is the lived experience,
yeah,
of people in the banlieue.
Yeah.
And people always say, Les banlieues, you know, and categorise them as, you know, poverty-stricken projects. And I mean, there are some very nice banlieues. It just means suburbs and
yeah,
some of them are very nice. But some of them are hellholes of, you know, where unemployment rages. There's lots of youth crime, boredom. And, you know, there is lots of bad behaviour by people who are who've got nothing better to do and are in a state of despair. But what I think struck me as one of the key differences, like we said earlier, you know, there's a lot of similarities with London, but also at the same time, it couldn't be more different. Where if you go on a weekend trip to Paris or have a week in Paris on holiday, you can walk 3 hours from one end, from the Eiffel Tower to, you know, Montmartre,
yeah,
and everything will be lovely and nice, you know, and
civilized,
wealth and beautiful, yes, buildings, and but you very rarely step out into the suburbs. And in the suburbs, they have these ghettos where there is this intense feeling of oppression, largely amongst people of Algerian descent. And people feel, you know, utterly hopeless and neglected by the government. In London, people who are less advantaged, they're in the mix. You know, I think, you know,
yes,
geographically, we live cheek by jowl.
It's a distinction. There's a fantastic book by a wonderful African-American scholar called Isabel Wilkerson,
right,
called Caste, in which she draws a very subtle but important distinction between racism and caste.
Right.
So her point is, the Deep South of the United States was a caste system. It wasn't just racist, it was a caste system, which is why, by the way, the Nazis went to the Deep South of America to learn how to do segregation when they were planning the Nuremberg laws.
Is that right?
It is, yeah. No, I mean, she writes about it in the book.
Wow.
And I think that the French have something which edges closer to a caste system. I mean, their approach to North African migrants and their descendants is, you know, again, one doesn't want to be smug because there are huge problems in,
yeah,
this country.
Well, the Windrush generation.
The Windrush generation.
But this is different, isn't it?
But this is different. And I think it's interesting that when there's an incident like this in the UK, it takes a while for the yes but brigade to come out and say, yeah, but, you know, he had a gun, or yeah, but,
yeah,
you know, what was he really doing? Marine Le Pen has already been all over this like a cheap suit.
Has she?
Saying Macron's sort of olive branch words, you know, pacifying words, urged for peace, you know, calm and order, were a massive betrayal, you know, and law and order must be restored. You know, this is, and I'm afraid to say that there will be a big audience,
yeah,
especially in the South, yeah, for that kind of rhetoric.
Well, there were polls in Le Monde, in the Times of France, you know, newspaper, in 1990, so, you know, still 30 years ago,
yeah,
but, you know, a generation. And it was something like 76% of people said that they were disposed against Algerian,
yeah,
descent, you know, and didn't trust them, basically, them, this othering of this group of people. And
they are, I mean, it's the, know, untouchables thing. It's like
there are parallels, though, I think, with, well, I mean, the parallels continue, such is history. But if you remember in 62, when after the Algerian independence was given by France to Algeria, and France, having considered Algeria bizarrely, you know, looking back, bizarrely considered it to be basically a region of France, you know, unlike its other African, North African territories, you know, it sort of considered Algeria to be basically part of France. 500,000 Algerians came into France, and, you know, very, very quickly. They were basically segregated. They were dumped in parts of town where no one else wanted to live, and they were deprioritized when it came to national housing. And, you know, this is only two generations ago, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's really on a much larger scale, that kind of sense of invasion.
Yes.
And France is changing. This isn't France. Now, I saw a quote the other day from what's that woman's name, Alex Phillips from,
yeah,
Reform UK, and she said something like, fed up of living in London, it doesn't feel like Britain anymore. To which Paul Mason, by the way, another
new European
columnist, brilliantly said, what is it? It's too many Huguenots, you know, it's kind of like, you know,
back to Stuart Lee
and the, you know, the feeling of invasion
coming over here.
And, you know, the idea that anything is fixed in time,
yes,
and that this place is
least of all London.
Yeah, you know, it's nonsense. Least of all London.
I mean, London is like a geological strata.
Yes, it is.
Constant change, you know,
yeah,
it's a great river city, you know, it's,
yeah,
been endlessly
changing. But maybe
changing,
that's one of the slight differences with Paris, where because of the banlieue and the people being shunted out to the suburbs and the centre of it largely remaining stable. You know, you can go to Paris from, I've been going for 35 years, more or less it feels like the same place, except every 10 years they're trying to burn it down because it this furious evacuation of hate occurs, you know.
Yes, I mean, it's the case that for all its problems, there is no part of London where you don't know that it's a multicultural city.
Yeah.
Not even the poshest neighbourhoods.
That's right.
You will know, if you walk around, you'll get that feeling very quickly.
That's right.
That's the way it is.
That's right. And I thought it was very interesting when we had the riots in 2011, which were, you know, no one was really quite sure what the hell they were all about.
No, they were. It was
that
a very
was the abiding.
It was a very destabilising. I mean, in the great British way that we do, we've kind of forgotten about it.
Well, I don't know what any of the answers to this are, but it certainly proves in that conversation that we're not blindly positive about French or European Union countries.
No, I mean, I think French politics is incredibly divided, and I don't just mean in the normal party political way, but in a kind of universal view where you have an Enlightenment elite view, which Macron absolutely incarnates, and then you have the Gilets Jaunes, Le Pen view, which is very different, really different.
Okay, well, that's pretty much it for this week. What didn't we talk about that you wanted to talk about?
Well, one thing was Russia.
Yes.
Gangster's paradise.
Oh, my God.
I mean it's incredible to think that less than a week ago, a man who looks like a lollipop man who was hit by a bus and used to be a hot dog salesman turned brutal, murderous, mercenary warlord, came within 125 miles of Moscow and at least trying to get his hands on the biggest nuclear arsenal in the world, 6,000 warheads. And it's one of the reasons why I think, and I wrote this in the New European this week, is that we must stay in Ukraine, but also be aware that Russia is likely to be unstable and possibly to a transformative extent. You know, this is a gangster society. You know, there are Chechen militias. The company Gazprom has its own gang.
Yeah.
You know, this is a society that no longer really operates according to the kind of institutional rules-based approach that we are used to. And that is bad news at any time. But when it's a nuclear superpower, it's truly terrifying. And I mean, just doing a ring round this early this week, it was very striking how many eyes in Whitehall and Westminster and the defence establishment are now looking at, in a quite serious way, the collapse of Russia and what, if anything, you can do. Because what follows Putin might not be better.
No, that's right.
So, you know, that is the ultimate watching brief, I think.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. By the way, how Gazprom are still allowed to sponsor major global sporting
events
is just unbelievable. It's like being sponsored by the Cosa Nostra, you know. It's like,
I mean,
it absolutely
shouldn't be an issue.
No. What else was going on?
I went to see the new Indiana Jones, last Indiana Jones. Jones and the...
Is it the last one?
Yes.
Is that a spoiler alert?
No, but he's said it and everyone has said it.
Yeah.
But he's 80 or whatever. And it really is Indiana Jones and the Dignitas Voucher.
Really?
But it's also that it's the Dial of Destiny. And the sidekick this time is not the disgraced Shia LaBeouf, but Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
Yeah.
Who sort of goes through the motions of basically being Fleabag as an archaeological adventurer, right? So you constantly expect her to break the fourth wall and, you know, raise an arch eyebrow. She doesn't quite, but I think, you know, she's a very gifted person. She's obviously a great writer. She's not the most versatile actor in the world. but, you know, Harrison Ford is de-aged. And I would call... It's a kind of film that I would call amiable nonsense.
How
right?
many marks out of 10 would you get?
Oh, not... I mean, no more than 5 or 6.
How does it compare to the rest of the series?
Well, I think the first three are very good.
Yeah.
I think that the last one, which is as long ago as 2008, was not so good. And this one is probably the weakest.
Yeah.
There's a sort of sentimental dimension to it because Harrison Ford... is sort of doing his Sinatra farewell tour of the various goodbye to franchises. But that's it.
And you know the famous, everyone knows this, I reckon, but the most famous scene in the whole franchise where Ford is facing the baddie in the first film and has the bullwhip in his hand and the guy pulls a knife out or something like this.
A big saber
and wields it at Ford, and then Harrison sort of like just insouciantly just pulls a gun out and shoots him and turns away.
Well,
and the story was that he had terrible diarrhea, didn't he?
Oh, that's right.
Did you know that?
I knew he had stomach upset.
Harrison Ford had awful diarrhea and could only basically stand up for about 20 seconds. So they improv this.
This film, like all such films, is full of what South Park calls member berries. Right. So there's that. That scene is, you know, archly referenced.
Is it great stuff?
No, absolutely.
Brilliant. Well, we didn't have time to talk about any of that, but maybe we'll come back to it at some point in the future.
Get well soon, Madonna, the microbial girl. poor Madonna.
There's no new issue of the New European this week because we did our fantastic referendum.
Super Sore Away,
double issue.
Yes. Still at the newsstands.
And you should subscribe if you don't pick one up at the newsstands. But there's some fantastic stuff in there, including the 10 lies of Brexit, which I did remark, you know,
yes,
we had to stop somewhere. But anyway, these are the 10 biggest lies of Brexit. So that's there. Don't forget the great subscription offer. That's theneweuropean.co.uk/2MATS, M-A-T-T-S, the number 2 MATS. There's actually a link in the show notes. Thank you so much as ever to producer Matt Hill at Rethink Audio.
The third Matt.
And until next week.
It's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
Goodbye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.